My name is Oliver Tickell. I used to be editor of the Ecologist magazine, where I would bang out about four articles a day, some of them mine, most of them other people's, and trying to make it the go-to place for environmental news and thought.
Yeah, but it wasn't just environmental, was it? I know you had a great interest in geopolitics because, of course, this feeds into the environment, of course.
Well, it does, and it is an essential component. And one thing that, yeah, I well, I'm just going to tell you, I had a recent conversation with a former senior BBC reporter on the environment. And I was telling him that I thought all of this trying to do anything about climate change while the world is so unstable and so much military expenditures are going on is actually a complete losing battle. Because all of those resources that are going into military spending and warfare, these are the resources that we need to turn the world over to clean, sustainable energy. And if you think, if we had clean, sustainable energy, we wouldn't be having these wars over energy. But because we have got these incredibly expensive, and Trump just fined for a $200 billion extra budget quantity from the US Congress. If we weren't spending these prodigious sums, the whole world could have clean, sustainable energy, clean water, and all of these things that we really need to advance this planet.
Well, and also, Oliver, China has just announced this week that it's now producing more of its energy from renewable sources than through fossil fuels, which is an amazing transformation.
Well, China's going very strong on this, and they are, in fact, producing most of the world's renewable energy capacity, and they are installing more of it within China than the entire rest of the world put together. So what China is doing is incredible, but I don't think it's motivated mainly by concern about climate change, although I'm sure there is a concern about climate change because they've had some really devastating floods and droughts and other phenomena. I think it's mainly driven because their sources of indigenous fossil energy are quite sparse. And so it makes complete sense for them to gravitate towards completely indigenous energy sources so that they are not dependent on the Middle East or Australia or wherever else for their energy supplies. Their aim is to be self-sufficient in energy and completely immune from any illegal tariffs or sanctions or whatever might ensue from rogue administrations around the world. And I'm thinking particularly, of course, of America. Speaking of rogue administrations and illegal energy sanctions, I just spotted a piece on the Cradle saying that Russia is now directly challenging America's embargo on energy to Cuba. And that is fantastic news because Trump and his administration have been completely illegally blockading energy supplies to Cuba. And they are absolutely desperate now. The whole economy is falling apart. The lights are going out. Buses can't run. Everything because of these incredible fuel shortages. And Russia is now sending 1 million tons of oil to Cuba.
I wonder if maybe Cuba is a bit of a canary in a coal mine here, is that, you know, many other countries could go the same way if the US carries on with these blockades. I mean, we had this business with Venezuela back in January, the kidnapping of the president, and also the United States pursuing Venezuelan oil across the Atlantic. So maybe they will start to take on some of these Russian tankers, board them even.
Well, they did that already, but not a genuinely Russian flag tanker. They have taken Russian tankers, but that followed a very swift change of flag to a Russian one, and there was no time to get any support vessels. Now, one thing for sure is that these Russian tankers on their way to Cuba now, they are going to have submarines following them. And there will be an attack capability. And these are genuinely Russian flagged vessels. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't think Trump's going to dare attack them. But I think that this is a sign of a wider outcome from this war in the Middle East on Iran, is that America's vulnerability is being revealed. The all-powerful America has suddenly bitten off more than it can chew in the Straits of Hormuz. And I understand that Trump is desperate to get out of it. He was led by the nose into this war, taking very bad advice from Zionist spinners within his own administration, particularly Kushner and Witkoff. Who are really Zionist agents within the Trump administration?
Look, before we get too deep into Iran, I'd just like to ask you about nuclear, because this is being seen in China and the UK as a great savior, sort of almost like a crusader riding towards us over the horizon. And I'm not
Well,
so sure about, number one, its environmental credentials, or number two, its price. And of course, actually, number three, is whether it's actually going to function. I mean, there's been quite a lot of problems with these actually having to shut these type of reactors down they're building at the moment.
nuclear power, the first question is why do private companies, why is private enterprise not stepping in to build nuclear power stations if it's such a good idea? All of the people supporting nuclear power tend to say that they favor free markets and private enterprise. Yet in the case of nuclear, free markets and private enterprise are not building and never have built nuclear power stations. And it's simply because the economics are terrible. And the only way that nuclear power ever gets built is with massive government support. So there is that sort of contradiction at the heart of it. And they say, oh, it's market failures. No, it isn't market failures. It's market operation. And the operation of markets says nuclear is rubbish and no one wants to put money into it. I always think, all of these nuclear proponents, fine. If you think it's so great, you sink your pension fund into nuclear power. I mean, in fact, I had this idea that I ought to start up a pension fund to invest in nuclear power just to see how many people put their money into it. I don't think anyone would. But the other thing is it takes such a long time to build. It's the time horizon to build the nuclear power is of the order of 10 years. So you have a problem now that you want to solve. You haven't got enough power. You want to switch to something that doesn't produce carbon dioxide. So you think, yay, nuclear. Well, all right. But, 10 years to wait before you get any power out of it, and 10 years of enormous investment. And you're just pumping all that money in over a 10-year period, doing all these massive civil engineering works, and you're getting absolutely no energy, no return on that investment. So that's a hell of a long time to finance something without any kind of income. Solar power station, producing energy within 3 to 6 months, wind turbines. Even offshore ones, a couple of years maybe. I mean, and they are cheaper. I mean, these are the cheap energy sources that are competing with fossil fuels and essentially cutting out fossil fuels, because as soon as you've got renewable energy, solar or wind or whatever, solar power coming onto the grid, basically the gas power stations are told to shut down because it's their expensive power that is pushing up prices. And the reason why England has the most or Britain rather has Europe's most expensive power is not because of our support for renewable energies, because we haven't supported it enough. And so we are still having the power price set by very expensive natural gas. And it's only going to get worse with
I was
the
hearing,
shortage of
sorry
gas.
to interrupt you, but I was hearing this week that those who own the wind turbines and solar panel farms are getting paid roughly three times what it would cost them on the open market, because the energy market is arranged in a certain way where all of the various different sources of energy all get paid the same amount of money for that energy based on what is the highest price, and that at the moment is gas, and so they're all getting paid as if they were gas power stations, and so it's an absolute amazing money spinner if you've been building wind turbines or solar panels.
It is an amazing money spinner, but that only applies to people who have not got contracts for difference. Now, the interesting thing with renewable energy is that most of it is being financed by very big, very risk-averse funds like pension funds, who are looking for a long-term, risk-free, guaranteed return, so that they know that they will be able to pay their pensions. And that's completely different from the fossil fuel industry, which has a, you know, an oil ha has a much riskier profile. It's high risk, high profit. Renewable energy attracts a different kind of investor. What that means is that they want to line up a government contract to sell their energy at a guaranteed price, which is typically quite a low price, but it's a price where they know that they can make a profit, and pay out pensions in the indefinite future. So almost all of the renewable energy is actually being built under these contracts for difference, which means that actually it's the government that is taking that profit. So the difference between the instantaneous price set by gas and the price set in the contract for difference, that money is being taken by the government itself and the renewables purchasing agency. And so that is bringing in a lot of money. Now, quite a lot of that money is also going in paying out on old contracts, which are expensive in terms of the power price. So what it means is that it's only after the 15 or 20 year period or whatever it is of that contract for difference, which guarantees the relatively low price. It's only after that contract has expired and that capacity comes onto the open market at that point, during that residual lifetime of these renewable energy assets. Then, yes, people can make a lot of money out of them when prices are high.
Okay, so let's look at how the energy market is likely to go, because we're seeing some amazing things happening in the Middle East, a war which is being escalated almost daily by Israel, and yet very little pushback, it seems, from Europe or even from the United States. The Israelis have been escalating things by arranging for these decapitation strikes, the assassination of military, political, and other leaders, and as well as also now extending the target range into the LNG gas plants, as they've just done this week as well. And this, of course, demands a response from the Iranians. This seems to be on an escalation spiral, or escalator, if you want, and I don't see any finishing anytime soon. So this is enormous, going to be affecting enormously energy prices, and I don't see all that much political or any other kind of
Well,
pushback against it.
I think that actually we're experiencing experiencing quite a big pushback. And I mean, Europe has pushed back massively just in terms of denouncing this entire criminal enterprise, which is Trump's war on Iran, Trump's war, and of course, Israel's war. And the steadfast refusal of other NATO countries to have anything to do with it, Europe's collective refusal to get involved, that is actually a massive pushback. I mean, it is unprecedented. But then Trump's behavior has also been unprecedented. To go into this war with no discussion with allies and sending out all kinds of weird messages, whether about Greenland or invading Canada, or and saying that he didn't want any help from these European countries anyway because they're useless, and then begging them to get involved, and then suddenly finding, no, surprise, surprise, they didn't want to get involved. And I just think that there is a sort of mood of rebellion, whether it's Russia saying, sod it, we are going to send that fuel to Cuba because it's the right thing to do. Or whether it's the Europeans saying, we are not joining your war, Mr. Trump. And a very interesting thing there that I just heard today from an impeccable source is that the Europeans are actually going to be doing a deal with Iran to ship out liquefied natural gas and oil from Iranian ports to Europe, paying a fee, and I imagine it won't be a small fee, but paying a fee for safe passage through the Straits of Hormuz, and all sanctions lifted. And that Europe will actually be taking direct delivery of gas and oil from Iran through the Straits of Hormuz. And that this is all worked out with Lloyd's insurers. And this is again a complete break with the past in Europe, actually acting in its own self-interest rather than just getting led by the nose into America, into conflicts and disputes and other kinds of illegal sanctions and other activities, which don't serve them at all.
So are you talking about at an EU level or independently the nation states of Europe?
Well, there was a statement put out, which I just saw on Telegram, by a number of European countries, which include Britain and Germany and the Netherlands, and I can't remember the rest, but a good consortium of European countries. And this I think relates to this deal that I mentioned. The actual deal itself is secret and not public, but it kind of opens the way to that, talking about finding ways of getting the Straits of Hormuz open to traffic and keeping Europe supplied. So I think that actually this also fits. And then there was another thing today on Al Jazeera, which was saying that Trump was actually open to lifting sanctions on Iran for the purpose of getting oil and gas out. So this is really rather a dramatic change. Europe standing up for himself, suddenly talk of lifting sanctions on Iran, of America lifting sanctions on
Iran. This is incredible, particularly since they are actually in the process of using RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire to directly bomb Iran from the UK using their B-1 and B-52 bombers. They can't overfly Europe. They have to go down the Atlantic coast right through the Strait of Gibraltar, flying over the top of that and down the Mediterranean to get there. But it's extraordinary if the Americans are thinking about lifting sanctions on Iran at the same time as bombing them.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's all getting very topsy-turvy. By the way, I've got my own theory about one reason why Starmer is letting those flights go out of RAF Fairford. And that is that he thinks that if he told America that not to, and he didn't want them to, they might just do it anyway. And then what? What are we going to do if Britain forbids America to bomb Iran out of RAF Fairford, and they just do it anyway.
Because
What
they have
happens
been
then?
doing that, haven't they? Pretty much what they want at their United States Air Force bases, like Marham, like Laken Heath, and Mildenhall in Norfolk. They are bringing in nuclear bombs, which obviously make Britain very much a target. I mean, it almost like it's a throwback to the
They
19. 19-
make Britain a target, and they also put, perhaps not us, but certainly other European countries hosting American nuclear bombs are actually in breach of the non-proliferation treaty.
Oh, yeah,
But
but this is the rule book is being torn up left, right, and centre, isn't it?
the various rule books are being torn up. And it's definitely getting interesting in terms of what's happening. And I heard another interesting thing today, which was a video by Chris Hedges with Max Blumenthal, which is available on YouTube, about all the stratagems pulled by Israel to get Trump into this war. And apparently one thing that's going on right at this very moment in time is that he doesn't believe the reports, even when he sees the videos of the massive damage being done by Iranian strikes on American bases and radar systems and Tel Aviv. And really, there is quite a large scale of destruction. Trump is being shown these videos and he's just saying, I don't believe it. You know, these are AI generated. Now, there is a lot of AI generated stuff out there, but these are actually videos being put out by major news organizations, which are definitely not AI generated stuff. And Trump just isn't believing it. He's living in this sort of delusional world in which he thinks that America is winning. And
well,
that, you know,
he's almost like a victim of the fake news that he used to point the finger at all the news outlets that they were the fake news, and he is becoming the fake news. But look, what about all of the tremendous amount of censorship, actually, of the damage in Israel?
Indeed, there is, but one thing I've come across now is that Israelis are so desperate that they're just saying, sod it, you know, prosecute me if you must, you know, whatever, you know. Obviously they'll try and conceal their identity, but they are just filming and getting those videos out. They are defying this law which says that they can't video the results of these Iranian strikes on their cities and infrastructure.
Well, and also, one thing I've certainly seen is it looks as if the Iranians are now targeting specific individuals' homes. I suppose this is in response to the decapitation strikes, and these may be homes of senior ministers or military officers in Israel.
Yes, and my understanding is that they have hit some very important people, including figures in the military, in Mossad, and many people believe Benjamin Netanyahu and Ben Gvir have left the chat permanently.
Well, yeah, but we've seen today Netanyahu out as a spokesperson. I mean, I think this is part of the problem, is it? We're supposed to be in this kind of post-truth era. But anyway, what about the religious and the spiritual aspects to this, Oliver? Because we've had the Al-Aqsa Mosque now closed, now nearly 3 weeks, and the idea is that the Israelis have always wanted to bulldoze that mosque and recreate the Third Temple. In fact, we've got the U.S. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth. He's banging his fists on the lectern and actually now praying too in press conferences, saying God is with us.
Well, Pete Hegseth is, I think, a desperate man, and he's desperate because he knows that this whole thing this whole war that he's so much part of has been spinning completely out of control. And it's almost like, you know, he's desperate for the Messiah to turn up and end times to happen, for the apocalypse to take place, because it's a way out for him. It's a way out. Because he is now in a very bad place. And if he was pulled up on a cloud and sucked up into heaven, well, you know, that would solve his problems, wouldn't it? But I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, it's also not going to help him actually win. In fact, it seems as if they've set out on this course, which is unwinnable without a plan.
With no plan at all. And this is one of the very interesting things about, you know, how this war was engineered to take place and engineered by Israel to take place. And according to Max Blumenthal, the answer is that Israel has been working on Trump for a very long time. So you can go right the way back to the assassination of Soleimani, the architect of Iranian resistance, who actually created the essential concepts behind what is happening now. And so Israel sold Trump on this idea of targeted assassinations of key figures. But this was only really a stratagem to get Trump sucked in, because once they had him sucked in doing that, they were saying, oh, you do realize, of course, that you will now be an assassination target from the IGRC. He's saying, what? He said, oh, yes, I mean, you've been assassinating their chaps, and so now they're going to be out to assassinate you. But don't worry, you did the right thing. It was in a noble cause. And so Trump is suddenly paranoid that he's going to get assassinated. So what's his response? Assassinate more people. Assassinate the Ayatollah Khamenei. But of course, the more he gets led down this path of assassination by Israel to eliminate threats and enemies, the more he actually becomes a target. So this is one of the stratagems that they use to get him completely sucked into this war and this whole cause.
Well, okay, so what about your crystal ball gazing? Where do you think this is heading? Because I'm starting to think maybe we should be stockpiling food, we should be stockpiling fuel, this sort of thing. You know, maybe the preppers were right.
Well, we do not depend on the Straits of Hormuz for our food supply, but there are people who do. So for those people who depend on the Straits of Hormuz for their food supply, they probably do want to be stocking food. As far as Britain's concerned, I mean, that isn't really happening. But certainly energy prices are rising a lot. Fortunately for us in Britain, we are covered by these energy price guarantees on gas and electricity. And it may be that all of these high prices will actually have to be paid by the power companies, the energy companies, without feeding through to consumers, and that would be good. But there are still problems with things like ammonia for fertilizer, which is generally produced from natural gas, and much of it is produced in places like Qatar. And so there will be problems with fertilizer supply, energy generally, production of plastics, which are key to our economies in many ways. I mean, everything comes wrapped in plastic. A lot of people wish it didn't, you know, but it is very useful stuff, although it has its big downsides. So I think that there are going to be huge supply chain shocks. Here in Britain, I don't think we're going to be running out of anything, but it will have a huge economic impact, and inflation will definitely get a get another big push like it did with the previous energy crisis, when Europe cut itself off voluntarily from cheap Russian energy, blaming it on Russia, although in fact it was an entirely self-inflicted wound. So, yes, economic shocks for sure, affordability crisis getting worse. One other thing I've noticed here in Britain is that suddenly Labour is actually starting to sound as if it wants Labour policies. And I put this down to the Green election victory in Birmingham, which has definitely given the Labour Party massive pause for thought because of being outflanked on the left and taking a really thumping election defeat. And they are suddenly, I think, thinking, hang on, we have to get our own voters or people who have been our voters to turn out and vote for us. We have to follow the policies that we were elected on. Now, why did it take them so long? I don't know. But suddenly they have twigged. Only today they were talking about rejoining the EU. Now, I'm not sure about that myself, but it is something that most Labour voters actually do want to rejoin the EU.
One of the other things that Labour has been doing, which did surprise me, was having a bit of a showdown with the petrol companies, the oil cartel, the Petrol Retailers Association, pulled out of a meeting at the end of last week with the government. Rachel Reeves is saying they're profiteering, Oliver.
Ed Miliband came in for particular criticism, saying that he was, you know, his rhetoric was endangering this safety of checkout people in petrol stations. I think a lot of that is just performative, because they do want to be seen to be standing up for consumers and bringing the costs of living down. And, you know, a few politicians making slightly inflammatory remarks, well, it doesn't cost any money, does it? And who knows, it might get a few votes. But there is a massive shifting of attitudes and presentation, and a lot of identities seem to be being redefined.
So this increase in fuel prices in the UK on the forecourts, 25 or so pence a litre, is it justified, do you think, or are the oil, is Reeves right? Are the oil companies price fixing?
Well, obviously the price of oil is higher. And in a way, because of the very high duty that we pay on petrol, you can have a doubling of the oil price. But that doubling of the oil price only actually produces, say, a sort of 20-30% increase in the price that we pay. So in fact, for most British drivers buying petrol, I mean, you don't want to be paying another 30p a litre, but for a lot of people, it doesn't make that much difference because we're already paying so much in duty anyway, which kind of masks the effect.
Yeah, but is Reeves right? Are they price gouging? Are they price fixing up just because people are watching the war on TV? Are they profiteering?
Well, one thing that always seems to happen is that when the oil price goes up, it's reflected very rapidly in the price at the pumps. But when the oil price goes down, there's a much longer time lag before
it's a ratchet.
So to that extent, I think you could say yes. But I think that actually the solution to that is probably to simply, well, no government can go analysing the exact stocks or committed purchases or whatever that the fuel companies have at any point in time. That would be impossibly complex.
Well, they'd have to renationalise BP to do that, wouldn't they?
Yeah. What I think they can do is to say that fuel companies are allowed to reflect the current spot market price for oil in the price that they charge at the pump. So when the price goes up, when the international oil price goes up, they can instantly start charging more at the pump. But the other half of it would be that when the international oil price goes down, they also have to instantly bring that price
it does,
down.
It does seem to me there's a lot of hot air. The government doesn't
so the,
seem to really be able to do anything.
By law, it should be such that the petrol price has to follow the international spot market price, and then that would be simple and straightforward. And sometimes the petrol companies might do very well out of it, thinking, "Ooh, we think the price is going to go up," and they'll commit to buying a lot of fuel at a lower price, and it goes up, and they're making profits. Other times, they'll do the same thing, and whoops, the price has actually gone back down again, and they've lost. You know, but just tying the petrol price by law to the international market price would be one way of stopping that price gouging, and a lot more effective than having politicians making speeches.
Yeah. Are the Iranians in a position to hit Fairford if they get fed up with the fact that, I mean, obviously this has been happening in the Gulf countries, which are much closer to them?
No, that would require an intercontinental ballistic missile, and they simply don't have one.
So the Americans are safe there. How long do you think that this war with Iran and Israel is going to go on for?
Well, word is that Iran can keep it up another 6 months. I think that that Israel will struggle to tolerate another 6 months of this. And of course, Israel still has supplies of interceptors, so that, and the Gulf countries still have interceptors. So most of the missiles, certainly the majority of missiles being fired at Israel and the empire friendly Gulf states, most of the missiles and drones are being intercepted, but the quantity of intercepted missiles is finite because they simply can't be built anything like fast enough. I think this war over time, all Israel has to do is keep it up for another. I mean, what are we? I mean, how long have we really been in this war? Not very long. If you think of it's going on for 6 months, all of those interceptors will be long gone after another month of this. And Iran will be really be able to send its drones and missiles pretty much anywhere it likes. And America and Israel will face destruction of their interests. In the case of America faces destruction of its missiles and its infrastructure, including industrial infrastructure, including banks, including technology centers, cloud computing centers and so on in the Gulf. And actually, there's an awful lot of American major technology infrastructure in the Gulf, and all of it is hittable. Israel is only a small country. It can only take so much. Iran hit an Israeli oil refinery today and took out apparently 17% of its... That figure is from somewhere else. But they did hit an Israeli oil refinery, which is the major oil refinery supplying all of Israel. And it did suffer damage. Maybe it did take out 17% of its capacity. But if all of these missiles are getting through and every missile is hitting a target because there's no interceptors, well, Israel will be finished, you know. Israel will no longer be able to function.
Well, yeah, but you see, the Israelis do have their nuclear weapons. Jeffrey Sachs has said that Israel is committing suicide, which is a fairly extreme way of putting it, but they're certainly taking it to the brink. Do you think they may eventually get to the point where they feel their whole nation is under threat and they have to use nuclear weapons? They've got 200 of them.
Well, at that point, they might actually sue for peace. And then the question is, well, what would that peace look like? If Israel says, look, we've had enough. We can't take any more. Talk to us about peace. And then they'll say, all right, well, these are our terms. And Iran has, in fact, published its terms. And they include things like total lifting of all sanctions. It looks like that one's happening already. The closure of all American military bases in the Middle East. Well, maybe they're just going to get wiped out anyway. And so it's just saying, all right, you've already lost them. The Gulf states probably don't want you back anymore because you've been completely useless. You haven't defended them. You've made them a target, So, I mean, that looks quite achievable. And then if you're looking at Israel, well, you're looking at really at the end of the genocide, the end of the pogroms and so on taking place in the West Bank. You are looking at the restoration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. You are looking at going back to the boundaries of, I don't know quite when, but 1967 perhaps, or even the United Nations legally mandated boundaries of Israel. There is an awful lot of rolling back to be done. The only way Israel would ever agree to any of this is to save itself from annihilation. Now,
You see, look, there is a problem here, and that is that the current leadership, Oliver, is has painted itself into a corner in a way. Israel is not the most popular nation on earth, even with its own people now starting to turn against the leadership. Although they still have majority support, that is starting to trickle away as the bombs rain in all around Tel Aviv, particularly. And as they are painting themselves into a corner, surely if they're given an option of having peace and possibly being impeached or otherwise jailed in Israel, being the victim of their own political democracy, they may decide to press the button.
There will be people who will want to press the button, but of course, the Samson option would result in the complete destruction of Israel. And people might actually think that survival, that some kind of survival is better than annihilation. But it's certainly true. I mean, the situation that is developing is potentially very dangerous. And another possibility to consider is that well, the previous Ayatollah Khamenei had a fatwa against nuclear weapons, and all of this thing about Iran developing nuclear weapons. I mean, it was a lie, and it was a lie because on purely religious grounds, it was considered a crime against God to have nuclear weapons. But with, as I recall, a proviso of except in a state of existential need. And only when there is an existential need for nuclear weapons in defense of the Islamic State is it actually permissible to have a nuclear weapon. It is that there is a possibility that Iran may be on the way to having one precisely because of this attack and that existential question that that attack has created. In which case, the use of nuclear weapons by Israel would be an act of suicide. And personally, I don't think that Israel would want to commit suicide. And I certainly hope I'm right, because with that suicide would come the deaths of huge numbers of other people.
And they may, but there may be. See, it seems to me there's a sort of desire to bring other countries in, whether it's the US, whether it's Russia, whether it's China, in to take part in this enormous battle that's starting to develop in the Middle East between the Israelis and Iran. Anyway, Oliver, where do people find and follow you if they're interested in online, etc.?
I sort of post things mainly on Facebook. I'm not terribly active anywhere else.
Okay, Oliver Tickell, thanks very much for joining us.
All right. Thank you, Tony.